This episode is brought to you by Google Chrome. You think you know a browser, but Gemini and Chrome? That's new. It can help you with practically anything on the web, like restoring a vintage motorcycle from a 50-page restoration blog, or finally break down that long article you've had open for weeks. Gemini and Chrome is here for it. Ready to make anything online make sense? There's no place like Chrome. Check responses, setup required, compatibility and availability varies 18+.
When you need to build up your team to handle the growing chaos at work, use Indeed Sponsored Jobs. It gives your job post the boost it needs to be seen and helps reach people with the right skills, certifications, and more. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need a hiring hero? This is a job for Indeed Sponsored Jobs.
Hey, Kusha, you have a new mayor-elect.
Yes, we do. My fellow New Yorkers elected Zoran Mamdani, a Democrat, to lead the city. And that was only one of multiple races Democrats won in the first major elections since Donald Trump returned to the White House.
So, Donald Trump, since I know you're watching, I have four words for you. Turn the volume up.
And the cheers kept going.
Yeah, it seemed like voters were responding to a few things this election, including really high energy bills, which partly stem from Donald Trump's all-out attack on renewables, efficiency, and climate policy. I mean, prices are rising in lots of places, and people are understandably upset.
Yeah, energy prices were on the ballot in New Jersey and also Virginia, where Democrats won both of the governor's seats. A couple of takeaways for me, affordability. So we're talking not just of energy, but also housing, food, healthcare, the whole affordability writ large continues to be a crucial platform for successful Democratic campaigns, as we saw in New York City.
Yeah, and not just New York City. In Georgia, voters flipped two seats on their state public service commission from Republican to Democrat. And, you know, utility commission elections don't usually get a lot of attention, but this is a big deal. This is the agency that can determine how people get their electricity and how much they can be charged.
Which leads to the second takeaway for me. This frustration around high energy bills could prove to be a powerful tool for Democrats in future elections as well. We'll have to see. For now, let's get on to the show.
I'm Ariana Brocious.
I'm Kusha Navadar.
And this is Climate One. COP is happening this week. COP is the acronym for the annual United Nations Global Climate Summit. The full name is actually the Conference of Parties, COP, of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. But that's a lot to say. So most people just say COP. And this is its 30th year.
Yeah, this is a tough nut to crack, and they've been at it for a long time. I mean, these conferences can be powerful. They can be important. I'm thinking of the landmark COP15, which resulted in the Paris Agreement. That's when virtually all the countries of the world committed to keeping global temperatures well below 2 degrees Celsius higher than pre-industrial levels, with a goal of holding the rise to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius.
And there's really no time to waste. We are already seeing increasing weather volatility and many more climate-related disasters.
Yeah, and in this context, every tenth of a degree really does matter. Unfortunately, we seem to be blowing past that 1.5 degree goal. According to the latest United Nations Emissions Gap Report, we're currently on track for roughly 2.8 degrees Celsius of warming.
And basically no country is doing enough to reduce emissions, though globally emissions are rising more slowly than they were a decade ago. Here's UN Climate Change Executive Secretary Simon Steele at the opening of COP30.
10 years ago in Paris, we were designing the future, a future that would clearly see the curve of emissions bend downwards. Colleagues, welcome to that future. The emissions curve has been bent downwards because of what was agreed in halls like this, with governments legislating and markets responding. But I'm not sugarcoating it. We have so much more work to do. We must move much, much faster on both reductions of emissions and strengthening resilience. The science is clear. We can and must bring temperatures back down to 1.5 degrees Celsius after any temporary overshoot.
Hang on. Did you catch that? Temporary overshoot. That's bad. It sounds like a rationalization for the fact that countries haven't met their initial goal.
Yeah, and Steele admonished global leaders, telling them they have to act.
Not one single nation among you can afford this, as climate disasters rip double digits off GDP. To falter whilst mega droughts wreck national harvests, sending food prices soaring, makes zero sense economically or politically. To squabble while famines take hold, forcing millions to flee their homelands, this will never be forgotten as conflicts spread. While climate disasters decimate the lives of millions, when we already have the solutions, this will never, ever be forgiven.
That is a scolding, but we also have made progress. I mean, we have really cheap solar power and batteries, lots of new technologies, the list goes on.
Right. And UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres reflected on this in his remarks, saying the UN will not give up on that 1.5 degree goal.
Because another truth is evident. We have never been better equipped to fight back. A clean energy revolution has taken hold. Solar and wind are now the cheapest sources of power and the fastest growing sources of electricity in history. Last year, almost all new power capacity came from renewables. The clean energy economy is creating jobs and driving development. It is reshaping geopolitics, delivering energy security and price stability. And it is connecting millions to clean and affordable energy for the first time.
It's exciting stuff. That's the kind of good news we need.
Yeah, there is lots of good news, but we're still not doing enough fast enough, which Guterres acknowledges.
The challenge is immense, but the choices are clear. No one can bargain with physics, but we can choose to lead or be led to ruin.
This year, the COP is being held in Brazil, in Belém, a smaller port city on the edge of the Amazon rainforest. And that choice of location created a bit of controversy. On the one hand, it highlights a region being hit hard by climate disruption. On the other, the city doesn't have anywhere near the number of hotel rooms needed to support the tens of thousands of people who wanted to attend, the Climate One team included. You know, normally we're on the ground at COP talking to people in person, but we aren't there this year, and frankly, the lodging costs were just way too high.
Yeah, and we're not alone in that. A lot of regular attendees are sitting this one out, or they're sending fewer people. Notably, the U.S. is not sending any high-level delegates this year. Although that's not due to hotel costs, I'm sure you can guess. Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement again, and his administration is seeking to roll back all the climate progress that was made under Biden.
So let's quickly cover some of the other high points of this year's conference. First, it's being billed as an implementation COP. That's another one of these jargony phrases. Kusha, can you help unpack that?
Totally. So typically at the end of the two-week summit, the nations all agree to a resolution committing them to more climate actions. A lot of recent COPs have resulted in big new promises, like creating a fund for loss and damage, which is what rich countries owe poorer countries for the climate harms that the rich countries have caused.
Or committing to rein in methane emissions, or reducing deforestation. Lots of promises.
Yeah, promises all around. So the idea of an implementation summit is basically to focus on how to actually turn those promises into action. That's the goal this year.
At last year's COP29 in Baku, Azerbaijan, world leaders agreed to work together to mobilize a big sum in climate finance, $1.3 trillion annually between now and 2035. Finance is COP jargon for money going from richer nations to developing ones to help them transition to clean, renewable energy quickly, much more quickly than they could without all that capital. And since most of the climate-harming emissions have come from developed, richer countries, you know, they're on the hook for helping these other countries out.
The leaders of COP29 and COP30 created the Baku to Belém roadmap, a structured framework for how to start mobilizing that $1.3 trillion. This is more than just country-to-country philanthropy. The idea is that setting up various funding mechanisms will spur a whole lot of investment from the private sector, and that money should go into things that are good for our climate and our people, rather than continuing to invest in the fossil fuel industry, for example. So that's a big topic of discussion at this year's conference.
And since we're not there in person, I asked our first guest, David Neustein, to give us a sense of what Belém is like.
Yeah, so Belém is a very interesting city, actually. First of all, because the city is in the middle of the jungle. It's a very rich city, culturally speaking. It's a city that is the gastronomy, a food hub in Brazil. The food here is great, even though it's very, very hot. It's near a river, and near not a simple river, the Amazon River, one of the largest in the world. And it's beautiful. You can see the forest from the city. There's this sensation of being part of nature. And even though the city is not the greenest city in the country, you can still feel something very embedded as human beings of being in the middle of a forest.
Belém is hot and humid, in fact, so hot and humid that the Brazilian government sent out a notice telling COP attendees that due to the weather, formal business attire will not be required.
Nothing worse than sweating through a three-piece suit, right?
yeah, totally. David Neustein is a sustainability consultant who's currently serving as chief of staff to Marcelo Bejar, COP30 special envoy for bioeconomy. Neustein co-wrote an interesting and provocative article titled, "Hosting COP30 in a Remote Amazon City is a Deft Political Maneuver." He was responding to the criticism about why Brazil chose Belém for this conference. We spoke to him from Brazil.
So choosing to organize such an international event, such as COP30, in the middle of the Amazon was very bold. We knew that Belém and Manaus didn't have the same infrastructure as a global city. We have global cities here in Brazil, such as Rio and São Paulo. But it was a political move and a political choice made by Lula's government. Putting your COP in the Amazon region is very symbolic for the Brazilian people. It represents 60% of our territory. And still, it is not embedded in our culture as it should be. So the idea of putting the COP in the Amazon, in Belém, I think it's also an idea of integrating the Amazon region in what we call the collective imagery of Brazil. All the myths and symbols that are common to a population. And we're not close to that narrative of the Amazon region. So I think...
So now Brazilians don't consider the Amazon a strong piece of their national identity.
No. And it's been a lose now for the last 5 years, let's say 10 years, to try to put this in this perspective. This is new because for the last 100 years, the main relationship that we had with the Amazon region is an extractive one. So the idea was to bring the cities to the forest. The idea was bring what they call the progress to the forest. And now we're understanding that we actually need to learn from the forest and let the forest come to us, let's say. Then there's the meaning for the world. What does it mean to put a COP in the Amazon region? Belém is not a small city. It's about 1.5 million people that are living there. It's a city that is losing in the last 30 years most of its vegetal coverage, let's say, or the forest and trees that you have in the city. Mm-hmm. And it's also a city where it's 40 degrees Celsius all the time. I don't know how much it is in...
it's hot. It's hot, humid climate, right?
Exactly. And when we say in climate change and in the climate industry, we are trying to limit the global warming to 1.5. 1.5 is an average. Actually, it's going to be 1.5 probably in New York or in Buenos Aires. But on the Ecuador, this temperature is going to be much more higher. Mm. And so Belém is an informal city, let's say, where the temperatures are almost unbearable. And it's a city that struggles with infrastructure in general. And when we look at the world, that's the same case of most of the population in the world, of most of the places in the world. So putting a COP in Belém is also showing a mirror of what is happening to the world. It's also bringing the negotiations and bringing all of the world to a place that in some ways is going to be probably one of the futures that is awaiting us.
Thank you for explaining that. There's another point that you make that I think is really interesting, which is that Brazil has this unique ability to speak credibly to both the global South and the global North. These terms we use to kind of distinguish generally the more high income developed countries from the reverse. Why is that? Why does Brazil hold that unique spot? And what can that help accomplish at this year's COP?
First of all, Brazil has a history of diplomacy. Brazil is one of the only countries that got its independence without a war. We negotiate. So it's very different from others. And maybe for that we have a different ability to discuss with everyone. Our Ministry of Foreign Affairs is very competent, has a long history. You know, in diplomacy and experience plays a huge part on how the countries negotiate and relate to each other. And the second thing is that they have to deal, and they are also the product, let's say, of a very diverse country. Brazil, you have the most inequalities. It's one of the most inequal countries on earth. So we have difference of incomes. We have differences of our geographies. So it's a very diverse country where you have a very diverse population. And we have this idea and also a little bit of this narrative that Brazil knows how to talk and knows how to negotiate and are friends a little bit with the rest of the world. And we have this ability as an emerging economy to discuss as well with China than with the United States.
It's also part of Brazilians' way of being, right? I've been fortunate to be friends and know some Brazilians, and a very warm, gregarious culture of people who like to socialize, like to be with each other, feel very proud and strongly about their country. There's a strong national identity, I think. So that goes along with that. So you're chief of staff to Marcelo Bejar, COP30 Special Envoy for the Bioeconomy, and you've been working with him and his team closely on sustainable development and the business parts of the agenda. Can you just kind of quickly give us a sense of what the focus is of those efforts and what the actions are?
Yeah. So what we're saying is that to achieve the climate goals that we have, to limit the warming, we're going to have to change the way that we produce and how we think about the economy. We have to show the private sector how it can be beneficial to go green for them and how they can still produce and at the same time be more respectful and actually doing this transition. The real transition and the energy transition, the green transition is going to really be material when we discuss and when the companies are going to be with us. And so part of our work and part of Marcelo Bejar's work has been in the last year, in the last year and a half, to engage with these companies, engage with banks, engage with food companies, engage with insurance companies, so that we can try to unify a voice of the private sector in this college. And part of this process with the COP30 presidency has been to identify which are the best solutions that already exist, that were already created by companies, and scale them up. So for the bioeconomy, we have some very good examples, internationally speaking, but also in Brazil, of companies like Natura, the cosmetic companies, that uses most of its base for cosmetics from the standing forest. So they go in the forest, they discuss with the local communities, they engage with the local communities, and these communities produce specific kinds of nuts, specific kinds of fruits that then become cosmetics that are going to send worldwide.
Yeah. So elsewhere in this episode, we speak with Deborah Sanchez, who's attending COP30, and she represents Clarify, which is a funding mechanism that gets money to indigenous groups doing forestry conservation projects all around the world. And so in line with what you're discussing, trying to make these communities more resilient, be able to develop their natural resources responsibly and provide for their own well-being. And one third of the physical space at COP30 has been dedicated to the action agenda, which is basically the space for the people who aren't in formal negotiations to ramp up their emission reductions, their adaptation strategies. That's part of what you're describing. What do you hope that amount of space, that amount of attention will achieve this year?
I hope that in general, people are going to get together and they're going to find common ground. So in the search compartmentalized world, where we have different sectors that don't discuss together, I hope that we're going to arrive and find common ground between the companies, between the indigenous people, that true leaders are directly in confrontation, which is also a big issue. But that doesn't mean that we cannot produce and live together, conclude this agenda together. The key word for this talk that was decided by the COP30 presidency is implementation. How can we put in reality what we have been discussing for almost 30 years now? And how can we find solutions to concretely put that in place?
Right. And you've said Brazilians are good negotiators. You've also said they're ambitious, I think, when we spoke before. So how is that idea of closing the gap between past promises and delivery visible or enacted in the agenda for this COP30?
So one of the biggest outcomes we are expecting to come now forward until the end of this COP is the TFFF. The TFFF is the Tropical Forest Fund Facility.
The Tropical Forest Forever Facility. I think that's
exactly.
The formal name. Yeah,
that's the formal word. Yeah, it's
a lot of
it's
acronyms.
Not a beautiful,
at COP.
Yeah, it's not a beautiful name, but the idea is very unique. For the first time in Brazil, and I think probably in the world, we have a finance ministry, a government finance ministry, that is working hand in hand with the environmental ministry, and they're building together financial structures, financial instruments to solve the climate problems and work on this agenda together, I would say. The idea is to try to integrate the protection of the forest into the real economy. And that's one of the main examples of what Brazil is trying to propose for this COP. How can we integrate the whole finance ministry, the whole private sector, the whole, let's say, productive sector with also the climate agenda?
Just weeks before COP30 started, the Brazilian government approved new exploratory oil drilling at the mouth of the Amazon. How does that jibe with the country's desire to be seen as an environmental leader?
So this process was very painful for Brazil. This is my opinion. I think the government didn't manage well to discuss the climate agenda inside the own government. And we had different forces. We had pro-climate, let's say, and pro-cost movements inside the government. And we had some other parts of the government that were having another vision, let's say, of what you should do with the oil drillings. And these visions were clearly to explore them and to use this money, let's say, for Brazil's development. Of course, they've diminished Brazil's leadership. I think the timing was very bad, just before COP. And I think it shows also the divisions that we have as an emerging country, meaning that we are leading this climate agenda. That's what the world expects from us in general, as a country that most of the Amazon forest is in our territory. But on the other side, they're also looking for development funding. We need money to create a better future for most of the people in this country.
Davi Neustein is a sustainability consultant for Climate Works and is also serving as chief of staff for Marcelo Bejar, COP30 special envoy for bioeconomy. Thank you so much for joining us and giving us your thoughts on COP30.
Thank you, Ariana. I was excited to be with you.
Coming up, we hear from the chair of AOSIS, the Alliance of Small Island States, about the importance of their participation at the Conference of Parties.
We've often been called the moral voice of the climate change process, and I think we take that role very seriously. And typically, AOSIS is really one of the most ambitious groups when it comes to climate ambition and transitioning away from fossil fuels.
That's up next when Climate One continues.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
This episode is brought to you by Google Health. Stop chasing someone else's definition of health. What matters is what's healthy for you. Google Health offers a new kind of coach built with Gemini for effortless tracking, sleep insights, and holistic coaching tailored to you. Visit googlestore.com to learn more and start a new relationship with your health. Requires Google account, Google Health app, internet, and Google Health premium subscription. Features subject to change. Availability and results vary. Not intended for medical purposes. Works independently of Gemini apps. Check responses for accuracy.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. Listening to this podcast instead of doom scrolling? Smart move. Another smart move? Getting help from one of State Farm's 19,000 local agents when you choose to bundle home and auto. Bundling, just another way to save with the Personal Price Plan. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Our next guest is a regular at COPs and familiar with the political and diplomatic avenues countries have to work on climate progress. Ilana Seed is the permanent representative of Palau to the United Nations and chair of the Alliance of Small Island States, AOSIS, a coalition of 39 small island and coastal developing nations. What's the energy like in Belém, and how does it compare with the other COPs that you've attended?
Well, I was just in Belém for the leader summit, and ordinarily leader summits are integrated with the regular COP. Brazil decided to do things differently, so they brought in the leaders before the COP started. So it was a little bit less chaotic, and so I think the leaders were a little bit isolated. The rooms were a little bit smaller. There was not a lot of that kind of frenetic COP energy everywhere, but there were, you know, quite a few, if I'm not mistaken, 70 or so heads of state that were there. So it was a really good showing for President Lula that his counterparts showed up to the summit. A lot of really good messaging around we need to keep the Paris Agreement alive. 1.5 degrees is still our North Star. We have to work on implementation and on finance. So I had the privilege of attending the leader summit with my president, and it was really heartening to hear that the system still is intact, and we're kind of still moving forward, at least at the leaders. Negotiations have now started, and we'll kind of have to see day by day how that pans out. But the reports I'm getting from my negotiators is, so far, it's very collaborative, which is not always the case with COPs.
Oh, that's good to hear. So you're the permanent representative of Palau to the United Nations, and I want to give listeners a sense of your country and its role in these talks. Palau is an archipelago of more than 300 islands and atolls in Micronesia in the Pacific. Your country relies heavily on blue tourism, as it's called, so, you know, scuba diving, sustainable aquaculture, things like that. How has the economy and overall life in the region changed because of climate impacts?
So just to give you very concrete examples, growing up, I don't remember too many typhoons. Historically, Palau sits outside of what's called the Pacific Typhoon Belt. So there was a storm on occasion that veered off course and school was closed for a day, and it was like a very, very rare thing. That's no longer the case. And so we have had super typhoons hit Palau pretty frequently in the last couple of years. One of them destroyed 20% of our infrastructure, our aquaculture facilities. So just within my own lifetime, I can kind of see and sense that the weather patterns are changing. We all also have kind of these extreme weather events. So we'll go for a long time without rainfall, and then it will just rain very heavily. And that heavy rainfall will damage roads, create mudslides, things of that sort. We are also going through another wave of coral bleaching. And so we're seeing that marine kind of heat waves are having an impact on our coral ecosystems. And that's very challenging for us because we, as you mentioned, we rely on blue tourism. A lot of people fly from very far away places to come scuba dive and snorkel. And so when the reef isn't as healthy as it normally is, it's kind of a challenging value proposition that will, you know, in the long run, have impacts on our food security. You know, we eat a lot of fish and a lot of seafood. So yeah, there's a lot of different challenges resulting from global warming. And as a result, it's something that our president and our administration has placed a lot of priority in engaging in the COP process and trying to really push for more ambition to say that small island developing states have these very severe repercussions from climate change, and we really have to work together to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees so that we can continue to thrive in our countries.
Right. And you've spoken very eloquently at many different global meetings about the impacts that we just talked about. And I think these issues like bleaching of the coral reefs, ocean acidification, these sort of global issues are really coming home in countries like yours. And I'm wondering if you feel like the voices of your country and your partners in AOSIS, the Association of Small Island States, is being heard by these other global leaders?
Yes, I actually think that the voice of AOSIS, or the voice of the Small Island Developing States, is a really important one at the COP. We've often been called the moral voice of the climate change process. And I think we take that role very seriously. And typically AOSIS is really one of the most ambitious groups when it comes to climate ambition and transitioning away from fossil fuels. We push really hard to get that language during the Dubai COP. And that, you know, that was a historical decision that changed the way that we think about the process. So, yeah, I actually think that we play a very important role in the process. We do think that our partners hear us. And at least the COPs that I've been in, we've been very integrated with the meetings that take place.
Mm-hmm. This year's COP is being framed as an implementation COP, basically trying to put promises into action. And we've already seen the launch of things like the plan to accelerate multi-level governance, which is essentially this effort to get more practical things done at the level, local level, on housing, water, buildings, infrastructure. Yet COP is still a really just a space for conversations and discussions. This work will have to happen after COP on the ground. Do you think that these discussions, though, will result in meaningful changes after leaders return home?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, just to give you one example that we've seen really materialize quickly is the Fund for Responding to Loss and Damage. So that was a decision that was adopted in the Sharm el-Sheikh COP, and it's operationalized now. And so fairly soon, countries on the front lines, including many small and developing states, will have access to those funds. I think it's around $900 million, so it's a little less than $1 billion. It's woefully inadequate to the level of loss and damage that's being recorded around the world. But we are seeing that for small islands, that things can happen fairly quickly. So yes, it's been billed as an implementation COP. Many people don't realize that the COP is not just one meeting. It's actually a circuit that runs throughout the year. So there are many, many dialogues. There are many ministerial meetings. You know, the Baku to Vlem roadmap was worked on throughout the year, and it's being kind of highlighted at this COP. So there are a lot of decisions and a lot of negotiations that happen during the COP, but there is implementation work that's being done as leaders leave and as negotiators leave.
You mentioned the Baku to Vlem roadmap, and I want to just talk a moment about that. So that came out of last year's COP summit, which was held in Baku, Azerbaijan. And it is essentially a plan, an effort to mobilize $1.3 trillion, which is a lot of money, annually to help countries transition to a clean economy, you know, renewable energy and so forth. Prior to your diplomatic work, you had a distinguished career in finance. And so I'm curious what you think of this effort and, you know, evaluating these attempts to get money to the nations who need it to do this work and really make it happen. I mean, are we seeing it happen?
I think we're seeing a lot of conversations happen. I wouldn't go as far as to say that it's actually happened in terms of things being implemented. It's really hard to innovate where institutions that were built a very long time ago and have very rigid rules, it's hard to change those. And I think that's one of the things that we're beginning to realize that, and we're trying to see how we can try to change some of those rules so innovation happens. So at the Leaders Summit in Belém, there was a lot of talk around how do we innovate the financial tools that we have. And a lot of leaders were saying, we're trying to innovate, we're trying to have our you know, finance people come with kind of new instruments and new ideas. But the boards of the institutions that control these decisions are largely saying we can't do that because of the rules that are in place. So it is a political process, but I think it's great that leaders are starting to understand that they're the ones who have to go and change those rules in order for those kind of flows of funds to be able to happen. The COP presidency also convened a kind of a finance ministerial group of champions to come and try to unlock some of the finance. And I think that was a really good idea, because I think in the past you have climate negotiators trying to broker finance deals, and that's difficult to do. They're technical, they're complicated. You need people who understand complex financial products to really try to create solutions, not climate negotiators.
Yeah, and I want to clarify. So when we talk about creating mechanisms or products or financial instruments, all these words, we're sort of talking about, I mean, just to be super basic here, like the bucket you put the money into, right? Different ways to take money from one place and put it elsewhere. But that's just creating the structure. The actual money hasn't really been allocated yet, or obviously spent in a lot of these cases. And the other thing about the term mobilize is the intention is to not just have money flowing from governments, right? But also to get the private sector to see this as a place to invest. In recent years, the COP has been criticized, including by some very notable climate leaders, for not accomplishing enough. And some have questioned the value of the whole UN process in achieving global action. What's your view on that?
I'm asked that question a lot. And when I think about it, I just don't know what the best other alternative would be. And I think that's where I get kind of stuck to say, well, it doesn't exist. So climate change is a problem that one country can't really solve by itself. We can't really do it with bilateral partnerships. It needs to be the entire world working together, because carbon emissions know no borders. And so that's where multilateralism has a really strong place. And so the UNFCCC process was started for that reason. And so is it challenging to get 200 countries to agree to something? Yes. Is it working a little bit too slowly? Yes, definitely. Do we have another alternative? Probably not. But I do think that the process deserves some credit for, you know, before Paris, we were on track to 4-degree world, and now we're at 2.6. And, you know, that's a result of what the process has done. It needs to get accelerated so that we reach the goal of 1.5. But I would say that it deserves some credit for the fact that it has reduced global warming by a few degrees.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the analysis going into this COP has said that essentially we have made progress. It's still not enough. Bill Gates' recent memo on climate change made the case that too much of the climate conversation is framed as doom and gloom. And I'm curious how you respond to that, and if you think we need a new or different narrative around climate.
Well, I think it's a little bit twofold, in the sense that the path that we're on is pretty dark for small island developing states. And I think that needs to be acknowledged. We shouldn't sugarcoat the fact that we need to accelerate the transition away from fossil fuels. But I do also agree that the narrative of just like admiring the problem is something that we might do a little bit too much, and we need to focus on solutions. And that was actually something I really enjoyed during this leaders segment in Belém. Is a lot of the countries came with positive implementation stories. Norway said that nearly 100% of its new cars are EVs. And that's a pretty incredible thing when, you know, just a few years ago, like EV absorption was not very high. A lot of countries were announcing huge, huge solar fields and saying that it was cheaper than kind of using fossil fuels. And so that they not only saw an economic advantage, but they also saw energy independence, which was important to them. And on top of that, it's meeting the goals of the Paris Agreement. So, of course, there needs to be more finance. There needs to be faster access for small island developing states. There are many things that we still need to do. But the narrative at the leaders' meeting was a little bit more positive, in the sense that you could see the kind of momentum threaded through many of the statements.
So I believe you're based in New York, but that's still a pretty good haul to get down to Belém. Your colleagues that are coming from places like Palau or other nations around the world, I mean, it's a long way to travel for really any COP, but, you know, this is another place that's kind of hard to get to. And I'm wondering, for you and those who are there, like, what's the value of being there in person and meeting other people from all these different countries who have similar or different challenges that you're facing?
I think it has tremendous value. And I know that there's a lot of conversations around, could some of this be virtual? In my opinion, there's no replacement for an in-person meeting when you're talking about things that are at times existential to your country and you're having a face-to-face conversation with somebody, you know, from Saudi Arabia, from an oil-producing nation, and trying to really understand their proposition as well. I think there's a human connection there that can't be replaced. And so when you have things that are very sensitive and very political, it really helps that you have your colleague with you and you're trying to work things out. And sometimes you don't see eye to eye, but it requires being on the ground for that, definitely.
Mm-hmm. By the time COP30 wraps up on November 21st or so, what would success look like to you?
I think for AEOSIS, one of the things that we are fighting to keep on the agenda is basically there's something called the Nationally Determined Contributions Synthesis Report. So countries were supposed to submit the 3.0 version of their NDCs. Not enough countries did that. So I think...
And that's, let's just explain really quick. An NDC is a commitment to reducing emissions by a certain degree, a certain amount.
It's your national plan. It consists of projects. Different countries have different priorities, but different projects that showcase your willingness and or plan to reduce emissions. And that can be on the electricity grid. It can be in transportation. So different countries have different NDCs, but basically it's your plan to reduce emissions so that we can collectively meet the goals of the Paris Agreement to keep warming within 1.5. So that was something that was supposed to have happened by this COP. Not enough countries submitted their NDC 3.0s. So what we're trying to do as AEOSIS is we need to determine what the response for that will be. So could there be a series of decisions that we can take that will mandate the COP to come back to encourage countries to submit their NDCs? Could there be political kind of convenings that will address some of these shortcomings? So that's a top priority for AEOSIS, is that we're falling short of 1.5, which is the North Star of the Paris Agreement as we see it. We need to come up with an official decision or response that the COP will take to keep that goal alive. Second is mobilization of finance. So I think very recently, maybe a couple of days ago, this Baku Tbilisi roadmap was released. We need to figure out how we incorporate that within the finance process to accelerate the implementation of, one, getting the $300 million package that was agreed to at the last COP, but also how do you actually create the enabling conditions to get to the $1.3 trillion. And then finally, adaptation is always important for small and developing states. And so increasing adaptation finance is also a key priority for AEOSIS, but also lowering the barriers for AEOSIS to be able to access adaptation finance.
Ilana Seed is permanent representative of Palau to the United Nations and chair of AEOSIS, the Alliance of Small Island States. Thank you so much for joining us and talking about COP30.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, we hear about an effort to get funding directly to indigenous peoples and local communities for sustainable forestry and land conservation projects they want to prioritize.
They can own their own vision around how their land, their resources can be managed and how they can enhance their lives through these processes.
And can we get this kind of funding to scale for climate benefits too? That's up next when Climate One continues.
Chronic migraine, 15 or more headache days a month, each lasting 4 hours or more, can make me feel like a spectator in my own life.
Botox, onabotulinum toxin A, prevents headaches in adults with chronic migraine. It's not for those with 14 or fewer headache days a month. It's the number one prescribed branded chronic migraine preventive treatment.
Prescription Botox is injected by your doctor. Effects of Botox may spread hours to weeks after injection, causing serious symptoms. Alert your doctor right away, as difficulty swallowing, speaking, breathing, eye problems, or muscle weakness can be signs of a life-threatening condition. Patients with these conditions before injection are at highest risk. Side effects may include allergic reactions, neck and injection site pain, fatigue, and headache. Allergic reactions can include rash, welts, asthma symptoms, and dizziness. Don't receive Botox if there's a skin infection. Tell your doctor your medical history, muscle or nerve conditions, including ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, myasthenia gravis or Lambert-Eaton syndrome, and medications, including botulinum toxins, as these may increase the risk of serious side effects.
Why wait? Ask your doctor, visit BotoxChronicMigraine.com or call 1-800-44-BOTOX to learn more.
Tomorrow morning is knocking. Stock your fridge now. How about a creamy mocha frappuccino drink? Or a sweet vanilla? Smooth caramel maybe? Or a white chocolate mocha? Whichever you choose, delicious coffee awaits. Find Starbucks frappuccino drinks wherever you buy your groceries.
Got a Sam's Cafe pizza order up. Mm-mm-mm. You know the best part about this spicy Italian sausage? I voted for this topping. Yeah, just another perk of being a member. Come join us. Sam's Club.
Deborah Sanchez has spent years working in forestry, biodiversity, conservation, and indigenous communities. She's currently director of Clarify, the Community Land Rights and Conservation Finance Initiative for the Rights and Resources Initiative. They direct money to indigenous-led conservation and forestry projects around the world. An indigenous Honduran mosquita, she grew up feeling connected to her homeland. After leaving her community to study, she returned and discovered her family and wider community didn't actually own that land. So she joined with others to advocate for securing the legal rights.
I realized that we were in risk of getting our land grabbed from the government or from anyone because we didn't have that specific rights to the land and sovereignty to the land. So my feel was feeling very vulnerable, feeling that something can just shift in the political status of Honduras, and then we suddenly were going to be homeless, right? And it was going beyond my own house because we will build that relationship already with the lagoon, with the forest. So we call, for example, that we are son of the mahogany trees, right? That we have all that belongingness. And so was thinking that all that we have in a territory can eventually be lost and can eventually be changed in something that we don't know and that will harm that relationship that we had.
And so you got involved in advocacy to get those land rights. Can you tell me about that work and what the result was?
So yes, I started joining the meetings at the community. So we basically went and record all the territory with the community. So we wake up in the morning, jump in this small canoe, go in the lagoon and then get into the rivers, upstream and get at 11 p.m. in the night in the community.
Wow.
Had a ceremony and dance with the community. And then in the morning, we talk with the community about how the rights are not secure and that we need to do this work. So it was a lot of connecting to people, connecting to the stories. And that's where everything started coming out. So all the stories about land grabbing, all the story about illegal logging, all the stories about wildlife illegally trading. So all that started coming out from the community members. And that's where the energy and the power came to continue the advocacy, to continue working. And so that's where also I realized that we need to start changing the whole system if we really wanted to impact the life of our community.
Mm-hmm. Does your community now own the land that you live on?
Yes. Now we have communal titling. So that was another advocacy piece. And then we had different territories within the bigger territory and each of those territories has own titling, collective titles.
So you've worked at this intersection of climate, forestry, biodiversity, and indigenous rights for many years. The Rights and Resource Initiative, which is a global coalition advocating for Indigenous, Afro-descendant, and local communities to own and control and benefit from natural resources, that's who you're working for now. They chose you to lead their funding mechanism that has the acronym CLARIFY. So it stands for the Community Land Rights and Conservation Finance Initiative. So lots of words in there. Can you tell me a bit about what that work entails? It's essentially moving money to help people with these projects, right?
Absolutely. So we do have and we've seen like women, youth and groups like what we had in the time in La Mosquitia, that effort, the willingness to really move our rights to title of lands, to protect our forests. But now we see a lot of the gap where the money is not reaching to people in the community to make sure they have the resources that they need to scale their work and to do their work. So basically, Clarify wants to fill that gap, and that's our vision. How can we mobilize funding directly to Indigenous peoples, local community, and Afro-descendant for their self-determined priorities, what means they can own their own vision around how their land, their resources can be managed and how they can enhance their lives through these processes.
What's the best example of a project that's been funded through Clarify?
So we have, for example, the Pygmy Women's Association in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where they were facing this trouble with agriculture. So they do agriculture, but with all this climate change, like the droughts, and then the soil become poorer and poorer every time because of some of the practices of slash and burn. This was impacting the women specifically because without income, then they had to leave their families and go to a nearby town. So we were seeing women that were going to cities just to sell the labor as a maid in the house or something. So they can earn a little bit of income and then come back to the families. But the families, the children and everything was left alone. So what we did with these women was that they got a project and they said, how can we learn new agricultural practices that will help us to face the climate change? So now we can have a better yield on the ground and we can have income and we can stay at home and we can take care of our families. So the project top line achievement was to include this adoption of resilient and sustainable agriculture. And now they were able to improve food security and they harvest 600 bags of shelled corn, for example, that they didn't have it before. And that is a very small scale because it's a group of women. But imagine with larger funding, how we can replicate and we can scale this type of work with other women around the world.
And that just makes so much sense, helping local women do sustainable agriculture as opposed to slash and burn, which you're saying makes the land more fragile to climate impacts. So teaching them to be more resilient, giving them those skills and abilities so they can stay where they want to be with their families. So let's tie this in with COP30, the Conference of Parties. Are these the kinds of things that the international community should be funding, the kinds of projects you just described?
Absolutely. For me, this journey to COP is been actually a journey of realization, right? So we need to really start understanding where the funding should go and what are the type of initiative that we, in the practical way, can make it happen. So these are practical solutions that we see there, that the only thing that we need to scale it up are funding, and sometimes the funding is going somewhere else. And that's basically the decision making that we want to achieve during this COP.
Yeah. And one thing I want to highlight for people is that the way, as far as I understand, the way Clarify works is that Indigenous people are both making the decisions about where that funding goes. And then Indigenous people are the people who are receiving these funds to do projects. Why is that so important that they're both the decision makers and the recipients?
I think that approach is so important because the funding needs to be intended from the beginning. And one clear example is if we have these women in Africa and we tell them, just write an email and write me the concept note, they will be like, what is all this about? So they were never going to be able to get the funding. But if we have facilitators in the ground that will go to these women, listen to the story, and then understand, oh, this can be a good project, and we can support this, and they can help them through go and help them to write the concept notes, share it with us. Then we see a different level of support that is there so these women can get the access to the funding. So even the approach, the what, is being widely shared here in COP and in so many places. We know we need to get the funding to Indigenous peoples. We know we need to get the solution of the Afro-descendants. But I think the how is the momentum now. And having Indigenous peoples, local community, and Afro-descendant decision makers is about the how. And having the communities being the one getting the funds is the answer, the final response.
Mm-hmm. So this year's Conference of Parties is being held in Belém, Brazil, near the heart of the Amazon. And the presidency has stated their commitment to elevate and include indigenous voices in the conference. How has that been playing out in reality?
So it is great because now we have a different approach. With even within Brazil, we have a minister of indigenous peoples. And we have been in the past working very closely with them to make sure that we have working groups. So people is there, is participating, right, in the whole process. And now at COP, we have the COP, Aldea COP, the village, where we are here. We can put our ideas there. We can put our events. People can come. We can be together. We can explore. And we are, for example, sharing the lesson learned that we have so far from all these amazing projects that have been happening through Clarify. So I do believe the intention of the presidency of the COP to having 1,000 indigenous peoples accredited was key. The preparation process was key, but also the actual event space for indigenous peoples, local community and Afro-descendant has been key to make it the participation very effective.
So the presidency has granted physical space in this, what they're calling the aldea, like Spanish for village, within the grounds of the COP where people gather and have discussions. So yeah, that's really great to hear. At COP26 in 2021, more than 100 countries pledged to halt and reverse deforestation and land degradation by 2030. We're now in the year 2025. Do you have a sense of that effort? Has it advanced? Do you know where any of that stands?
I do think there is an effort ongoing in this process, but it's still a lot to go, right? We are not nearly there. And why? Because the drivers of deforestation, they are shifting, but they are not away from the process. So now we have, for example, new trends on critical minerals that are needed for the whole energy transition process. And these are going to impact some of these lands and some of the forests that indigenous peoples, local community has been protecting over time, but also the, what we call our houses, our home. And I do think more regulation, more policies has been in place, but it's still implementation ongoing, right? From a lot of efforts that needs to be aligned for everyone. And then the other piece that needs to be thought importantly is around the development strategy of our countries. So when you rely on the natural resources for your development, how we can balance our development and the income generation and getting the people out of poverty with the sustainability use of those resources that we have. And we are just seeing a lot of silos. So people talking just about their forestry or talking just about policies around climate, but not putting everything together in one big strategy. So I see some progress, but we still need to see more implementation on the ground.
Yeah, there's been, with the Amazon itself, Bolsonaro allowed a lot of deforestation, a lot of development. Lula da Silva, the current president, is really trying to restore protection for the Amazon and slow deforestation just in this one mammoth important forest, right? I'm kind of wondering what you think we can learn from the Amazon itself and how it's managed in terms of indigenous land management in other forests around the world.
Yeah, I think it's important to see how we are connected to the forest and the vision that we have for the forest and actually the value that the forest has for the ecosystem, but also for the development and for everything that we know. Because sometimes we are only counting the gains, but we are not counting the losses. And every time we lost forests and we became more vulnerable to climate change, that brings a layer of more infrastructure that is needed to adapt and more money that needs to go into that. So what we can see is this whole effort from the indigenous peoples the local community, the Quilombolos, that are the Afro descendants living in the Amazon, engaging with different governments, engaging with different stakeholders, trying to put together a different strategies on how to protect and how to manage. It's a whole effort. So what I see is we are putting everything in the table to really make a decision and to really move forward with what we need, but also what the planet needs, because this is not just about us. This is about the survival of the humanity.
Deborah Sanchez is director of Clarify, the Community Land Rights and Conservation Finance Initiative with the Rights and Resource Initiative. Thank you so much for joining us to talk about COP30.
Thank you, Ariana, and thank you, everyone. It's nice to be talking to you.
All right, it's the end of our show, and we have time for just one more thing. Kusha, what have you got?
So I was on a flight last night from JFK in New York to Salt Lake City, and partway through the pilot says, hey, everybody, look to your right. You can see the Northern Lights.
What?
Ariana, I've never seen the Northern Lights before, and I saw the Northern Lights from a Delta flight, and I was sitting on the right side of the plane, and I look out, and it is this gorgeous tapestry of like neon green and red, and it's rippling. And I just stared out the window. I was so excited. It was beautiful. I took pictures. Have you seen the Northern Lights before?
Never in person. I am so jealous. It's like one of my bucket list items.
Mine too. I will send you the photos. In fact, listeners, I'll send you the photos too. Just go to our newsletter next week. They'll be there. I promise.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. You can see what our team is reading by subscribing to our newsletter, and then you can see pictures of the Northern Lights. Sign up at climateone.org.
Climate One is a production of the Commonwealth Club. Our team includes Greg Dalton, Brad Marshland, Jenny Park, Austin Colon, Megan Basilia, Ariana Brocious, and Rachel Lacey. Our theme music, that's by George Young, and I'm Kusha Navidar.
When it comes to my policy, Farmers gives it to me straight. So there's no surprises.
It's your coverage. You should never be confused.
You hear that? An insurance provider with a conscience.
We're a choir, but yes, we have that too.
Straightforward coverage you can literally understand. That's what you get when
you have Farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
Learn more at Farmers.com. Underwritten by Farmers Truck or Fire Insurance Exchanges or Affiliate. Products not available in every state.